welcome back to another edition of the Athletic Hockey Show. I'm Ian Mendes alongside Sean McIndoe on this episode of the podcast. It's another week, another strange firing on the Canadiens coaching staff. Speaking of strange, we've got ourselves a situation brewing in Minnesota between the Wild and Zach Parise. We'll take some of your listener questions via email and via voicemail. We'll talk about bad narratives in the NHL that maybe we got to get rid of, and also talk about the idea of four-on-four hockey. And we'll wrap it up, as always, with This Week in Hockey History, featuring one of the most memorable days ever for Mario Lemieux and Teemu Selänne. Sean, before we get to all of that, I got to ask you, Toronto just goes in and dominates Edmonton on Wednesday night. Okay, and it feels weird because it feels like it's like this entity that transfers between or amongst Canadian fan bases, where sometimes it's Calgary, so it was Ottawa earlier, it's Vancouver, now it's Edmonton. They're panicking. I just need to know, what is the psyche? Is it fair to say that the Toronto Maple Leafs fan base has the most solid psyche of any fan base in Canada right now?
I mean, we should, based on how the season is going. Do we? I don't know. I think a lot of that depends on how long you've been a fan. If you're relatively new to this, you're like, this is great. They got the best team on paper. They're way ahead in the standings. They're going to finish first. This is fantastic. If you're a bit of an old timer like I am, maybe not as much confidence, because you're sort of waiting for things to go wrong. But I got to say, this is in all my many years as a Leafs fan, the only time that I could point to and compare to what it feels like right now is probably the beginning of that 93-94 season, where they start the season 10-0, set an NHL record, best start ever. They had just gone on the long playoff run in 93. I don't know if you know about that. We don't talk about it very much as Leaf fans, but there was a playoff run in 93 that was pretty good. It's now year two of Pat Burns. You're sitting there going, well, was that real last year, or was that just one of those fluke things? And they come out of the gate 10-0. And I've said that was the only time in my entire life as a Leafs fan, playoff, regular season, offseason, where I think you could have legitimately said the Toronto Maple Leafs right now are the Stanley Cup favorite, because they were just rolling over everybody. And then they went pretty much 500 for the rest of the year and ended up having a good playoff run, but didn't win a Stanley Cup. So that's kind of the caution point if you're looking at right now. But that was a long time ago, and it's taken a long time. I've seen some good Leaf teams and some bad Leaf teams, but I've never seen a team that is just rolling over everybody like this. And yeah, it's the Canadian division. Yeah, the North is maybe not as strong. They're not beating Boston or Tampa or anyone like that. But when you go into a Edmonton and you face a team like the Oilers that have won, 7 or 8 out of 9, and you just, to win 3 games in regulation is one thing. They just dominated. I mean, that looked like just a big league team against a bunch of tykes. It was not anything I expected. All sorts of fun to watch. Who knows? We got a long way to go in this season. We may look back and go, yeah, that was the peak. But right now, this team looks real, real good.
Yeah, it was with surgical precision that they took apart the Edmonton Oilers in those 3 games. And like I said, it feels like the Oilers fan base is now the one kind of scurrying and trying to figure out what is going on. Hey, we're trying to figure out, Sean, what is going on in Minnesota, where the Wild on Wednesday, their head coach Dean Evason made Zach Parise a healthy scratch for the first time in his career. Now, Parise had been a scratch maybe late in the season when they had locked up a playoff spot. This is the first time in 9 years Parise is a healthy scratch. And just to paint the picture, just so everybody knows how this or why this all came to be, Monday night, Minnesota is playing Vegas. The Wild have a lead late in the game. They're up by a goal. Marcus Foligno has 2 goals in the game, has never had a hat trick in his career. He's on the ice with Parise. Parise has said to him, hey, have you ever had a hat trick before? And Marcus Foligno says, no, I haven't. So Parise says, I'm going to get you the puck at some point. Well, his final shift, he gets stuck out there. He was trying to get Foligno the hat trick. It doesn't work out. He ends up, kind of being on the ice for, I think, $1.33, and everyone points the finger at him. Dean Evason says, I'm going to scratch him. Parise says, it's disappointing. I don't agree with it. Then the Wild get pumped again on Wednesday night. I'm always interested, Sean, when elite players with big, or at least big time players with cap hits like Parise, 4 more years at that $7.5 million, is a healthy scratch. As you and I look at this kind of from 10,000 feet away, what's your takeaway from Parisi and Dean Evason this week in Minnesota?
Yeah, well, I mean, they're going to have to work it out. That's the short answer. This isn't a situation like Pierre-Luc Dubois getting scratched in Columbus and you go, okay, this isn't going to work. They're going to trade him. There's lots of teams that are going to. Nobody is lining up to get Zach Parise at $7.5 million for four more years. So they've got to figure it out. And I think they will. You're talking about a veteran player. You know, he doesn't strike me as the sort of guy who's going to go off and sulk about this. He'll learn from it, and they should be able to move on. But it was an interesting move to me because you're talking about a veteran player. You're talking about a relatively new coach. You know, this is Dean Evason. This is his first full season behind a bench, and to have it happen at a time when things were going really well in Minnesota. They had rolled off six straight wins before that loss on Monday. They were playing exciting hockey. There was a buzz around this team for the first time in maybe forever. I can't remember the last time I was excited to talk Minnesota Wild, but they're a fun team this year. If there was ever a time where you think maybe a young coach might say, you know what, I'm going to let this go. I'm not going to rock the boat right now. That probably would have been the time. And that doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing, because you want to have your expectations and your rules, and you want to say they apply to everyone. And there's no better way to make it clear that the rules apply to everyone than to enforce them on a older, popular veteran player. I thought the whole explanation about getting the hat trick was really interesting. And I've heard some fans who are very much on Zach Parise's side. You know, they thought he was doing a good thing. And there's other fans, not so much. It's one of those funny things in hockey. If he had been hanging out there to get himself a hat trick, there'd be no discussion about right or wrong here, right? We would all be criticizing him. You can't do anything in hockey for your own numbers. But if you're trying to help out a teammate and get his numbers, we all love that. And we see it all the time, right? How many times do you see a guy go down, he's got a shot in an empty net, but he stops, he pulls up, he makes a pass and tries to get a goal for somebody else who's struggling or looking for their first goal or whatever it is. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. The problem here is it did lead to the tying goal going the other way. And I get why you would want to send that message. Say, guys, there is no personal accomplishment. There's no personal number for you or any teammate that is more important than us winning games here. And I would assume that Zach Parise is going to be back in the lineup after one game. It's message delivered and you move on from there. But it will be interesting to see how it plays out, because we have seen over the years some younger or rookie coaches take this action with veterans and have it not work out very well for them.
You know, as you mentioned that, the first thing that comes to mind, and I feel like this might have been a game against the Leafs, you would know. Steve Kasper coached the Boston Bruins,
and he
stapled Cam Neely to the bench. What I find fascinating is, like, Neely played, right? Like, he dressed for the game and didn't take a shift, right?
That is the all-timer. That is the all-time example of a young coach kind of getting out over his skis. And because it was, first of all, it was Hockey Night Canada in Toronto in Maple Leaf Gardens. So, I mean, the biggest spotlight that you can have in the hockey world. And it's Cam Neely. I mean, if there has there ever been a player who's more heart and soul to a team, who has literally bled and fought and sacrificed his body for a team. And to do it that way, like you said, it wasn't that Cam Neely made a mistake during the game and got benched. It wasn't that Cam Neely made a mistake in previous games and got told, head to the press box, you're not playing tonight. He put him in the lineup. Cam Neely suited up, got everything on, sat on the bench, and then Steve Kasper didn't put him out for a single shift. It was just an over-the-top attempt to embarrass him. Kevin Stevens, too, got the same treatment, another veteran. And the Steve Kasper era in Boston never recovered from it, because there was no way you were going to win a popularity contest with Cam Neely in Boston. And that was where the fan base, media, everyone just kind of turned on him, and he wasn't the coach for much longer. That's the extreme. This is nowhere near that, thankfully, and hopefully won't be allowed to get anywhere close to it. But yeah, that's always the one that I think of as the all-time great, what was a coach thinking going this hard after a guy that he knew he wasn't going to win that battle with.
You know, and I don't mean to put more work on your plate, but when I hear the name Steve Kasper, there's one thing that it eats at me, and I'm like, this is a down goes Brown column if ever there was one. In 1982, Steve Casper wins the Selke Trophy as the league's best defensive forward. He's a minus 18. Like, I love your deep dive pieces, trying to figure, put some pieces together, puzzle something. Can you do me a favor at some point? It might be an off-season story, kind of a summer. How did a guy who is minus 18 win the Selke Trophy as best defensive forward?
And I think, if I'm right, he was like 20 years old at the time, too. So it wasn't even like this was some lifetime achievement award to some guy who had been like close for a decade. A 20-year-old minus 18 was the Selke Award. That might have to be one of those oral histories where we track down each of those voters and you know, catch them outside and put a microphone in their face and go, what were you thinking? Because I'd love to know, too. And that one is that's an all time mystery.
I bet you he probably had one game where he like shut down Gretzky, and then they were like, this guy is great.
Probably had a big game.
Yeah.
Hockey Night in Canada at Maple Leaf Gardens. And then years later was like, well, this is the place, right? I'm magic here. That might have been it.
I could do no wrong in Maple Leaf Gardens, says Steve Casper. we're talking about Parise and the Wild, and that is certainly a soap opera. It's got nothing on Jack Eichel in Buffalo, Sean. And since you and I have did the show last Thursday, it feels like the temperature's been turned up even more in Buffalo. So as I look at this, I see there's three possible outcomes for Eichel. One is they trade him before the deadline, April 12th. The second would be at some point in the offseason. And then the third would be they hang on to him. But the key to the whole thing with Eichel is his no-trade clause kicks in next summer. So the summer of 2022. At that point, then Eichel can control where he goes. Up until next summer, Jack Eichel can be traded anywhere, and he really can't say anything. I'm looking at this, and I'm wondering, what's the move here? If you're the Buffalo Sabres, what's the move? Kevin Adams, we talk about rookie coaches, rookie general manager. Man, Sean, this is quite a spot to be in.
Yeah, this is a tough one. I mean, the move is, out of the three options you just laid out, the strong preference is option three. If there is any way to make this work, if there's any way to have Jack Eichel be the guy that you build around, that's what you do. Because guys like this don't come around often. We saw what the Sabres did to get this guy. I mean, they basically punted 2 years, just a full-on 2014-15 full-on tank job, knowing they were going to get Eichel or McDavid, and all the damage that came with that, and all of the ridiculousness with their fans cheering for the other team and all of that stuff to get this guy, to hit the reset button years later, I think would be a last resort, but they may not have a choice. I mean, it is not working in Buffalo. We saw the back-to-back shutouts over the weekend. You can fire the coach. Yeah, you can move some other guys. But at some point, and I don't think it's a Jack Eichel problem at all in Buffalo, but at some point you just have to say, do we just have to amputate here and just completely start over? And that's when you get into the trade situation. And look, I'm almost always on the side that says if you're going to move a guy and it's during the season and you've made up your mind that that's what you're going to do, do it at the deadline. Because then you should be able to get a better price because the team that's picking him up is getting that extra playoff run out of him. They don't have to pay a lot of his salary this season. I remember Eric Carlson a few years ago in Ottawa. I remember feeling like they should have moved him at the deadline. They tried. Apparently things fell through. They waited till the offseason, didn't get as good a deal for him as they were hoping. But that was a guy who had 1 year left on his deal. Jack Eichel still got a lot of time left on this. And I really feel like, especially at his price tag, $10 million, on the cap, even late in the season, there's not a lot of teams that are going to be able to take that easily. I feel like this is probably one of those moves where you got to say, we're going to wait until the offseason. Take some phone calls now, plant some seeds, throw some names around, get other GMs thinking about what would need to happen. But then you wait until the offseason and you hope you get a real bidding war. And you can end up naming your price. If it feels like you're being forced, this is that old Elliot Friedman thing, right? Where the other GMs never throw you they don't throw you the life raft. They throw you the anchor. There's going to be a lot of anchors getting thrown towards Buffalo these days. Kevin Adams has got to figure out a way to turn this into a bidding war, and he should be able to. You only need two or three teams, and there should be 30 teams out there that are interested in Jack Eichel. If you can do it during the season and you feel like you have to, of course, go ahead. I think he's going to get a better situation in the offseason and take your time a little bit, because this will be a franchise-defining move if it happens.
And as I look at it, he's got 5 years left at $10 million per season. And so I think you know what you're getting in Eichel. I'm a huge Eichel guy. I believe when he's at his elite level, he's one of the best 10 players in the game. And because he plays that center position, I'm looking at this, and you're saying 30 teams should be lined up for Jack Eichel. But if I'm – look, if I'm Kyle Dubas, I'm not kicking the tires on Eichel. I got that. If I'm in Edmonton and I'm Ken Holland, I don't think I'm kicking the tires, right? Am I – like, I'm saying Edmonton and Toronto would be on the no-go list. Like, are there other teams that you would say would be on the no-go list for Jack Eichel that wouldn't even make the call?
I would say every team should make the call, including Toronto, including Edmonton. Now, look, realistically, if I'm Edmonton, I'm sitting there going, if I could get Jack Eichel, that means I can put your Seidel back on Connor McDavid's line and have an insane first line, and then I come back with Jack Eichel in my second line. Of course, I'm interested in doing that. Realistically, there's no way that deal works, right? There are no other assets that Edmonton has that they can turn around and use to get Jack Eichel without moving one of those two guys who they wouldn't move. But make the phone call. Who knows? Maybe Kevin Adams has an irrational admiration for Darnell Nurse, and he really wants that guy. And like that can somehow, you know, it's worth making the call and finding out. Same with the Leafs. Same with, you know, a team like Pittsburgh, where they've another top-heavy team that's already got two centers. But yeah, I think those teams are going to drop out of the bidding pretty quickly. And look, I mean, at the end of the day, everyone should be interested. We've always seen teams always emerge that we don't expect. But I think everyone's looking at two teams here, and that's the Rangers and the Kings, two teams with lots of youth, lots of prospect picks, lots of cap room. And it's going to be interesting to me to see, you know, if that's what it comes down to, or do we actually, does Kevin Adams pick the best offer, or is there a preference to say, you know what, if I'm going to trade this guy, I want to trade him out west where I'm not going to be running the risk of running into this guy early in the playoffs, running into him multiple times a season. I want him out in LA where my fans aren't going to be watching him every single night in a Rangers uniform going, that's what we could have had.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Like, I look at those two teams you mentioned, the Rangers and the Kings, and they just happen to have, Sean, the first and second pick in the most recent draft, right? And Alexis Lafreniere and Quentin Byfield. If I'm the general manager in New York or LA, right? If I'm running things in either of those spots, I would 100% be willing to give that up, plus obviously something else. That's just me. I hear from Rangers fans, we've thrown this out, Rangers fans saying, I would never do that in a million years. I would never trade Eichel for Lafreniere plus plus. But I'm thinking, I know what I have in Jack Eichel. And I think he's a legitimate, like, you hope that's what you get in Quentin Byfield and Lafreniere. Yeah. I don't think that their ceilings are as high as Jack Eichel.
That's exactly it. I mean, it's funny because we had a similar discussion on my other podcast on Puck Soup, where we were asking, would the Devils give up Jack Hughes for Jack Eichel? And Greg Wyshynski, who's on that show, is a Devils fan. And he was like, oh, no, I wouldn't give up Jack Hughes. And Ryan and I were like, you're crazy that you have to give up Jack Hughes plus, plus, plus to get Jack Eichel, because Jack Hughes, like Quentin Byfield, like Alexis Lafreniere, although it's a different position, those are all guys where you look at them and say, what's the ceiling? What's the best case scenario here is that you get a Jack Eichel type of player. And Jack Eichel is already a Jack Eichel type of player. Now, he's older. Yes, the cap hit is higher, although his cap hit is very reasonable for what he brings to the table. I can understand that if you still feel like, and maybe this is where a team like the Devils would be, you're still in rebuild mode, you want to hold on to the youth. You feel like your window is open 3 or 4 years from now. But the Rangers think their window is open now or should be soon. The Kings' window is clearly opening right in front of us the way they're playing this year. That's absolutely a move that you're willing to make. It's going to cost you more than that. And I know every fan base in every sport falls in love with the prospects. You always see the best case. You always, you know, somehow that ceiling turns into a sure thing. But in this case, I mean, the ceiling for these guys is that they become the next Jack Eichel. So if you can turn them into the current Jack Eichel, of course you look to do that if you feel like it lines up with the timing of what you're trying to build.
Yeah, I think that's going to be so fun and interesting to watch to see how that situation plays out in Buffalo. Last week when we did this show, Sean, we talked about how Montreal Canadiens shocked everybody. They let go of Claude Julien, and they had another change to the coaching staff this week. And I would say, certainly not to the magnitude of letting Claude Julien go, but from a surprise factor, this was up there. And the way that this shook down, for people who aren't familiar with the situation, Montreal Canadiens are playing the Ottawa Senators this week in a game, and they let go of their goaltending coach, Stefan Waite, and they did it in the game, during the second period of the game. Mark Bergevin then says later on, look, we've made the decision. Carey Price was not consulted. And I'm curious about this. They brought Sean Burke in, and I almost feel like they were like, well, if we do it in the game, it's like, there's Carey's alibi. He was on the ice. He obviously had nothing to do with it. But
Where were you Monday night?
Yeah.
No, look,
I was right there.
Yeah, but I was on TV.
It couldn't have been me. But I find it odd that you would have done it. And you know who I actually felt bad for? Dominic Ducharme. This guy wins his first game in the National Hockey League, he didn't want it to happen this way. It did. And you finally get your win behind the bench. And guess what? Oh, by the way, you fired your goalie coach during the game. So I just thought the whole thing, I'm going to use the word awkward. I felt it was awkward.
It definitely was. And God bless Montreal, where this is front page news. Yeah. My Twitter feed blew up. He would just, wow, oh my God. And it was like over a goalie. And I realized at the time, and this is true, I was like, do I even know who the goalie coach of the Maple Leafs is? And I didn't. I had to go and look it up. I'm willing to bet most fans listening to this probably don't know who the goalie coach of their own team is.
Who is the Leafs goalie coach?
It's Steve Bernier, something like I'd have to double check it, but it's not like a well-known ex-NHL guy. And that's, you know, very often, but unless you got Mitch Korn or Francois Allaire, you probably don't know who your team's goalie coach is. But it's Montreal and the way it went down. And this is one of those things where a lot of times when somebody says something and it seems unreasonable and people go, oh, that he's lying. Mark Bergevin is lying here. There's no way that Carey Price didn't have a hand in this. A lot of times it just gets down to you just parse what they said and you realize that actually there's a middle ground here that could make sense. Was Carey Price in the loop on this? You know, did Carey Price go out on the ice Monday night knowing that his goalie coach was getting fired? No, probably not. Did at any point on Monday, did he know it was happening? No, probably not. Did Carey Price have no idea that this was a possibility and he was perfectly happy and wanted to continue and this was a total blindside to him? No, that does not pass any sort of smell test on something that would make sense. There's no way that you fire your franchise goalie's coach if that relationship is going great and the goalie loves him and you're not going to blindside a guy like that. Especially to do it on a night where for the first time forever, Carey Price played pretty well, had one of his best games. And it just kind of all got overshadowed and maybe only in Montreal where something like that could happen. But the timing of it does make it a story because we just saw two coaches get fired, a head coach and an assistant. If you had fired the goalie coach then, I don't think anyone even really raises an eyebrow. But the fact that you wait a few days into this new coach's tenure and suddenly it happens, that's going to strike people as unusual.
Speaking of awkward departures from coaches, that was kind of the theme of your column this week where you looked at midseason and I don't know if you choose, because sometimes I'll have a hand in choosing the photo that goes with the article, but you had the Gerard Gallant getting in the taxi cab as the photo. As you went back and you basically looked at every in-season coaching change since the 2005-06 season. Was there any, like, was there anything that surprised you? Like, I think a lot of times when I go into articles, I'm like, I have an idea of what I think it's going to be. And then you do the research and it's either it confirms what you thought or it takes you down another path. Anything surprise you about your research in doing this piece about the in-season coaching changes?
I mean, the first thing that surprised me was how many there were, because I came up with this idea and I pitched it. And then I sat down like, listen, there's probably like 20 of these things. And then, you know, I go and I find that there's almost 70. So that was the first thing. It surprised me how often we see in-season changes where the GM takes over, even GMs who don't have coaching background, or at least at the NHL level. Obviously, Lou Lamoriello's done it. Don Waddell did it once. Bob Gainey a couple of times in Montreal, although he had had the coaching experience. Even Bob Murray a year or two ago doing that. And it's never a good sign, right?
Yeah.
When the GM is like, yeah, I want to get a look at this roster. It's like when the boss shows up and everyone's got to act busy. So that surprised me. And then the other thing was just that there are certain names that just show up over and over again on this list. And if you've ever felt, I know a lot of people feel like coaching the NHL is an old boys club and it's the same names coming in and out all the time. And I don't know that's totally true, but when you're making a list of like 67 of these moves and there are guys whose names show up five times, like Claude Julien, this has happened five times to him. Once getting hired, four times getting fired. Even guys that are lesser profile, like John Stevens keeps showing up in these things, over and over again. Ken Hitchcock, certain interim coaches just keep showing up. They keep getting the job for a few months and then they go back to being an assistant. So if you've ever felt like the NHL is the same names getting cycled in and out, looking at a list like this probably reinforces that, because especially if it's during a season where maybe a team has limited options, they just go for the familiar, and it's the same guys just showing up all the time.
John Torchetti, that's the guy.
The guy. Torchetti and Horacek are the two permanent interim coaches who never get the job. 20 games and then see you later.
Sean, let's open up the mailbag. And in fact, today we're going to open up the voicemail once again. We want to remind all of our listeners here to the Athletic Hockey Show, you can drop us a voicemail. We'd love to hear from you, and we'd love to answer your questions by hearing your voice. All you got to do is drop us a note. It's 845-445-8459. 845-445-8459. To the voicemail we go. Let's listen in from James from London.
Hi, this is James from London. I was just wondering, what's one popular narrative around either a player or a team that you completely disagree with?
All right, Sean. So we're talking about maybe narratives that don't quite fit. Is there anything that jumps out to your mind or comes to mind for you to answer James's query?
There is, yeah. And this is one that it drives me crazy. And I've been banging this drum for years, and I'm not seeing any progress. So I'll try again. It drives me crazy that we attribute everything that happens in this league to character and compete level and heart and grit and basically how bad everyone wants it. That stuff exists and that stuff matters. And yes, some players work harder than others and some teams work harder than others and there's ebbs and flows and that does have an impact. But my goodness, to hear the way that we as fans and we as the media talk about this league these days, we make it sound like every single year there are 31 teams and one team works their very hardest and that team wins the Stanley Cup, and then 30 teams don't work hard enough and they have to then spend the whole offseason trying to figure out how can we work harder? How can we get better workers? How can we learn to compete and get heart and be hard to play against and all of this stuff? And there's so much else that goes into it. You almost never hear these days anyone say this team didn't have enough skill, or this team didn't have enough speed, or this team didn't have got out coached, or this team didn't have the strategic approach, or whatever it is. It's just always, always, always they didn't want it bad enough. And like I've said before, it's at a certain point, this becomes kindergarten thinking. This is when you tell like a 5-year-old that if they just try their very best, they'll always win and they'll always succeed and they can do anything they want. You just got to try really, really hard. That's not how it works. This is a league with 31 teams. And, you know, sometimes the other team's just better. Sometimes the other team's goalie gets hot. Sometimes you're the better team, but you don't get the bounces. And we should be able to talk about that too. But it just feels like these days, absolutely everything, every game, every playoff series, every season, all comes down to who tried the hardest and who wanted it more and who had the best compete level and all these different ways that we've come up to say the same thing. And I think we're doing a disservice because there's so much more interesting stuff to talk about instead of turning this whole league into a contest over who wants to try the hardest.
So now I need to know, like, what is the message to the kindergarten kid? They're 5 years old. What do we tell them?
Yeah. Yeah. Here's the thing, kid. If you're out there against Connor McDavid, he's going to score on you no matter how hard you try.
So yeah.
And if the other team's goalie gets hot and stands on his head, that's the end of it. And you could have tried as hard as you wanted, and it wasn't gonna go anywhere.
Yeah, you know,
that's what I tell my kids. By the way, it might explain why they're I can't get them to make their beds now. They're, no, sorry, Dad.
There's no point.
Put the effort level into it. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Thanks for the pep talk.
Yeah, like. You know, for me, as I look at this, and you kind of did a column on this, and I think, I can't remember when it was. It was a couple of weeks ago. But the idea that, you know, you always hear people say, you know, if Canada had a B team at the Olympics, we could win the silver medal. That day is over. Like, it's over.
Yeah.
I it's done. And it was great. Like, when we were kids and we grew up and, Steve Yzerman would be cut from a team and we'd be like, wow, Steve Yzerman would be on any other team's first line and look at us. I got to tell you, that day is done. That ship has sailed. I don't think we could ice a second team from Canada and expect to end up on the podium anymore. That's just me. And especially your article, again, my timing is just off.
It was a couple of weeks.
A couple of weeks ago. Yeah. But it's just like the goaltending, first of all, I was like, woof. Like, this ain't Marty Brodeur and Patrick Waugh and Ed Belfour and Curtis Joseph. And like, this is like, what? Like, it's over. Like, hey, we might have a hard time getting the goalie position for the A team. Forget about this B team, right?
Well, first of all, I want to say congratulations in advance on all the Devils fans and Mackenzie Blackwood truthers who are now going to be tracking you down to explain to you why he is actually an A team goalie. You know what, it's certainly not to the same extent it used to be. I do think that a Team Canada B team, if there ever was such a thing, would be competitive with a lot of nations A teams. But yeah, on the podium, they're not going to beat Canada A, obviously. I don't think they're going to beat Team USA because Team USA looks really strong heading into next year, and the Russians are always good too, and the Swedes as well. So you're probably on the right track on this one. It's certainly not like it was 20 or 30 years ago where, probably a B or a C or a D team would have been competitive against pretty much anyone other than the Soviets.
When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. When you're trying to grow a business, the caliber of person you bring in to help you do that is really important. And LinkedIn makes it really easy to interview the right people for the role, quality people. LinkedIn isn't just a job board. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. On LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn. 2.5 million small businesses use LinkedIn for hiring. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/NHL show. That's linkedin.com/NHL show to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
So again, appreciate that voicemail, James. Anybody can leave us a voicemail, 845-445-8459. You can also drop us an email, theathletichockeyshow@gmail.com. Theathletichockeyshow@gmail.com. We got a couple here into the mailbag, Sean. Mark writes in, can you guys imagine a world where it's just 4-on-4 for the entire game? Was watching the Leafs and Oilers play almost 2 full minutes 4-on-4 earlier this week. It was eye-opening. More room to move, more things happening. It was like somebody turned the game speed up to 1.5 times the speed. You could even keep the same numbers on the team. Maybe you would roll out 5 4-man units, and so that way you wouldn't have to lose any jobs. I know hockey will probably never change, but I can dream, right? Maybe if we keep proposing wild things, they'll give up and just make the nets bigger. That comes in from Mark.
So
Mark,
I like it. Mark, good job, Mark. I like how Mark jumped on the bigger nets bandwagon at the end there. He was starting to, I was getting a little shaky there, but he brought me back at the end.
I know. And don't you love it how all of us have been screaming for years about maybe make the nets bigger. And then Ken Dryden's like, here's a very thoughtful essay on why. And then we're like, okay, well that. But what do you think about this? Like, we've heard this tossed around for a long time, Sean. 4-on-4 is so much more fun and exciting. Why not go 4-on-4 the whole game?
Yeah. And look, I think we should be open to ideas like this that maybe seem a bit crazy or at least they go against the tradition of the game. There was a time in my life as a fan I would have shut the door on any of this and said, nope, the game's great as it is, but I'm more open to this stuff. You want to talk to me about how we should get rid of offsides? Okay, I'll listen to that. You want to talk to me about 4-on-4? Yeah, let's talk about it. I would caution two things. First of all, we don't know what 4-on-4 would look like for 60 minutes just in terms of the fatigue on the players. And they, you know, and obviously, yeah, you could rotate more lines, but we see it in short bursts. We saw it in overtime for a few years there, but we haven't seen it for 60 minutes. Who knows? The thing that really worries me is that I still think that part of the reason that 4-on-4 looks so different from 5-on-5, you're sitting there going like, it's one fewer player. Why does it seem so much more wide open? Why does it seem so much more back and forth? And unfortunately, I think the answer is because the coaches haven't had a chance to really sink their teeth into it. And I think if we ever switched to 4-on-4, yeah, there would be a time where it would still feel wide open. But pretty quickly, all of these 31 head coaches that are all defensive-minded coaches, because that's all you can be these days to be a hockey coach, would eventually figure it out. And it would be kind of like it was with 3-on-3, right? When 3-on-3 overtime first came in, it was just chaos and it was beautiful. And then it started to get more structure and you started to see some coaches and they've kind of grinded it down to as defensive as it can be, which is still pretty wide open and fun. But I feel like they do the same thing with 4-on-4. So I'm not against the idea. I just caution that when you see the Leafs and Oilers play it for 2 minutes, they probably haven't practiced 4-on-4 barely all year long. Don't assume that that's what a whole game would look like if we changed that rule permanently.
Okay, here's my proposal, kind of piggybacking off of that. You get to have one period a night that's 4-on-4, and the home team determines before the game which period it will be. First period, second period, third period, and you one period will be played 4-on-4.
I like it. In fact, you know what? I'll go one further on you then, okay? Because I love the element of the strategy of the team picking.
Yeah.
Let's say we do 10 minutes of 4-on-4, but the home team gets to pick when, and they don't have to do it in advance. They just call the ref over and go, we want to go 4-on-4 right now. And that's it. The ref goes over to the other team, says it's 4-on-4 for the night, and then however long that shift lasts, and then they can, and it becomes really strategic then, right? Like we just got you on an icing. We're going to throw we're going to throw McDavid and Draisaitl out there, and we're going to play 4-on-4 against you for a while. And of course, if you're late in the game, you could do it then. More strategy, more wide open, and it would be rare enough that maybe it doesn't get all the life coached out of it. Man, we might be onto something on this one.
Yeah, I think at some point we got to do like just a show where it's just just give us your craziest, no idea is too nutty. Like, you know, no idea is too nutty. And then we workshop them on the podcast, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Okay. We can save this league. With some crazy ideas.
Yeah. Hey, listen, we love to wrap up every week, Sean, with This Week in Hockey History because it's so much fun. It usually sends us down a fun little rabbit hole. So let us start, as we're in the first week of March here, let's start with this. March 2nd, 1993. See, Sean, I didn't realize these two things happened on the same day. That is, Mario Lemieux comes back. It's one of the most memorable comebacks in NHL history. Lemieux comes back from cancer treatment and goes to Philadelphia and scores a goal and gets cheered by the Flyers fans while playing for the Penguins on the same day where Teemu Selänne breaks Mike Bossy's single-season goal-scoring record and then does that infamous goal-scoring celebration where he throws his glove up in the air and shoots it down like his stick is a rifle. I mean, you want to talk about one of the most memorable, iconic regular season days in NHL history. Boy, Sean, it'd be hard to top March 2nd, 1993.
That's right up there. And I'm with you. I had forgotten until you showed me this, that those both happened on the same day. That's crazy to me. And it just, again, I a couple years ago, I did a piece where I ranked every NHL season, and I put the 92-93 season as the number one best season in NHL history. And I stand by that. And this is just the fact that you would have a day where both of these things happen. The Mario comeback story, an all-time great story. I mean, when in January of that year, when he announces he has cancer and he's stepping away, there were a lot of us who wondered if we would see him again, period, in the league. And you certainly didn't think you would see him that season. And, you know, he goes and I think he finishes his last chemo treatment and pretty much heads right to the rink almost straight from there and goes and plays. Just unbelievable, amazing comeback, amazing emotion to it and everything. And one of the all-time great seasons. He then spends the last month of the season in overdrive catching Pat LaFontaine for the scoring title. Just phenomenal. And then, yeah, the Timo Salani goal that we've all seen a million times is the fact that that happened on the same night. What do you even lead with as your lead story if you're the nightly highlight show? That's a great one. And this is fun because I was actually talking to somebody about this a couple of days ago. Do you know, it's one of these fun trivia questions, when Timo Salani throws the glove up in the air and shoots it down, which teammate tries to catch the glove?
Is it Dallas Drake?
It is. No, you know what? You're close. I thought you had it. It's Dallas Aiken, actually.
Oh, the Dallas, current the coach. Oh, geez.
Coach of the Ducks. And here's the thing. The reason it came up is because I've mentioned that a couple of times, and I've always phrased it as which teammate caught the glove. But I had people point out to me, he actually doesn't catch it. He muffs it. He kind of does this cool, like one arm go to catch it, and he drops. I need somebody to ask him. I feel like that's the sort of thing that still bothers him. Like almost 30 years later, that's got to grind on you a little bit, that like, you know, this cool celebration and, you know, you go to like be a part of it and you muff the catch. That's, I mean, I know he's got a few other probably bigger things to worry about these days, but yeah, someday when I get my big sit down with him, that's going to be the lead question and we're going to get to the bottom of it.
Okay. Now help me out because I don't know why I had that in my mind. Did Dallas Drake play for Winnipeg?
I'm sure he did at some point. I don't know if he was playing.
Because he played for Detroit, yeah, right?
Drake? I feel like Dallas Drake played for you. He played for pretty much everyone except for Dallas, I think.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but I think he was a Jet at some point, but he wasn't the guy that night trying to catch the glove, trying and failing.
Yeah.
To catch the glove.
I appreciate you not making a joke about a guy from named Dallas, knowing I'm a Cowboys fan, muffing an easy. An easy fair catch there.
That's a missed opportunity. Now I'm mad. Now I'm mad at myself. Now Aikens and I have something to talk about.
Okay, but in a weird way, I'm going to bring this back to the Cowboys for a second and Mario Lemieux, because here's what I find fascinating about that night where Lemieux came back into Philadelphia. If you think about Philadelphia sports fans in the 90s, and really this has been the reputation forever, like ruthless, right? Like mm-hmm. You think about them, they cheer Michael Irvin. He's laying motionless on the turf at the Vet, and they're mm-hmm. cheering. Okay, this is the same decade in which they cheer for Mario Lemieux coming into the Spectrum and playing against him. Like, to me, that's one of the most remarkable exhibitions of sportsmanship from a fan base that has the exact opposite as the reputation. Right? Like that was what a tip of the cap from the Philly fans to Mario Lemieux.
For sure, and I know that there's a certain segment of the Philly fan base that hates this narrative and this idea that they're, you know, they're so mean and they threw things at Santa Claus and all of this, but they did. All of that stuff actually happened. I don't want to sound like an old guy here, but this was back in the early 90s. It wasn't like today. These days, anytime anyone gets hurt, everyone's expected to, you know, be very quiet and stand up and applaud. And everyone was mad at Raptors fans when they cheered and Kevin Durant went down and all of this stuff. Back then, it was just expected. Somebody got hurt, you stood up and cheered and pointed and laughed as they went off the ice, and that was just how it was. But yeah, obviously with Mario Lemieux, it was a totally different thing. You're talking about a guy getting cancer. You're talking about a guy who looked like his career is in danger. And just Mario is one of those guys that there's maybe not a lot of them even in NHL history, but you obviously hated watching them tear your team apart. But it didn't matter how big a homer you were. You had to appreciate that this guy was in the league and this guy was doing what he was doing. And I think it was a rare moment where even a fan base that would probably be the last one to give a rival an ovation, you had to appreciate what he had just overcome and just what he was as a player. The fact that this was now back in the game. And then, of course, he goes and scores on you because, of course, he does. What else is he going to do? He's Mario Lemieux.
Yeah. Also on this this week in hockey history, Sean, March the 6th, 2000, one of the most memorable trades in and around a deadline, the Boston Bruins send Raymond Bourque to the Colorado Avalanche in a deal that obviously shook the Bruins fan base. What people often forget is they think that Bourque goes to Colorado and wins the cup that year. It didn't happen, right?
They're
losing a game seven in a conference final to Dallas. And then come back the next year and win it. That is that Bourque to Colorado is the gold standard of deadline deals, right? In terms of like star power, guy moved to go try and win right now. I mean, I don't know if we even have any guys like that sitting around this year, but that to me on this date in 2000 is one of the most iconic deadline moves of all time.
Yeah. I mean, anyone who reads my stuff knows that I've got this recurring bit that I love of the old guy without a cup, the story of the veteran guy who's done everything in the league except win a Stanley Cup and goes somewhere. And we've got guys like Joe Thornton would probably be the great example right now. Henrik Lundqvist was one of those guys. Patrick Marleau would be another. And yeah, it comes down to you always want to see them lead their team to the cup. But if they can't, there is something about that late season deal of, okay, send me somewhere where I can go. And Ray Bourque was the classic of that. And it wasn't a good deal for the Bruins. The Bruins didn't get the best deal possible. They got the deal that worked for this guy who had given them 20 years. And it ultimately did work out a year later. And I don't think there aren't any Ray Bourques who are going to be available this year. I don't know. The Sharks have tried it with Patrick Marleau a couple times. I don't know if they do again. A guy like Ryan Getzlaff is a veteran. He does have a cup already, but he's a veteran on a bad team who maybe you could see going somewhere. I think this year's deadline is going to be a very strange one. We might not see any sort of these kind of moves, but it was great. And to this day, you can find the most grizzled, angry hockey fan and you talk about Ray Bourque lifting the Stanley Cup while his son cries in the background and you'll soften him up a little bit because it was an all-time great moment.
So are you suggesting the Leafs might flip out Thornton and Spezza then at some point to a contender?
That's what I'm saying. Yep, absolutely. Yeah. To a contender who's not in the North Division, because we all know the North stinks and no one from there can win anything.
Yeah, that was a fun narrative this week. All right, Sean, that does it for this episode of the podcast. Fun as always. Who knows what we'll have to sink our teeth into next week. But look, enjoy the games coming up this weekend and we'll chat again next week.
Right on. Sounds good.
All right. And thanks everybody for joining us. Like I said, we'll get you again next week. You can always drop us a voicemail, like I said, 845-445-8459, or an email to theathletichockeyshow@gmail.com. And if you're not a subscriber with us at The Athletic, you can join at theathletic.com/hockeyshow. I'll be back at it to wrap up the weekend on Monday with Haley Selby.